I always like that first hymn that we sing. If it sounded a little Gilbert and Sullivan-ish to you, that's because the music was written by Arthur Seymour Sullivan. But the best line in the whole hymn is, "Led them with unmoistened foot through the Red Sea waters." Don't you ever want to ask the question, didn't their feet get a little wet when they were walking across it? No! Unmoistened foot. That has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm going to preach about, but it just hit me, you know, as things do. Easter is the centerpiece of the Christian year, and on every Easter, it affords me the opportunity to say to all of you who come all the time and know this, but to say it anyway, and those of you who are here visiting, seeking, or coming, that you are welcome at St. Luke's Church, wherever you find yourself on your spiritual pilgrimage. Some of you may find the liturgical life here a little baffling, but you know what? Nobody's keeping score, and the liturgy will carry you. That is why we are a liturgical church. So you should always feel that the liturgy has its own momentum. I'm so grateful as a member of the clergy to be in a liturgical church, because I would have been out of this a long time ago if I'd have had to invent it every Sunday. Not a good thing. So I'm going to talk about three theological ideas in my sermon that I received from Father Thomas Keating that he says characterizes the Easter season, indeed the whole of the liturgical year, to say some things about what they mean for us and the shape of the Easter liturgy and its power and importance. And then on Easter, I always feel that it is an opportunity to remind ourselves what we have on offer as Christian people and how we might understand it and living into it and understand our responsibility as human beings to be the transparencies and reflections of God's grace and love that we're called to be. Father Thomas Keating says there are three great theological ideas that are made present to us every Easter: God's light, God's life, and God's love. And these three theological ideas are present to us in our worship and were to the early Christians initially. So I always say on Easter, a thing that we often forget, not all traditions hold this to be true, but as Episcopalians we do, the church is prior to the scriptures. The church is prior to the scriptures. We got the scriptures in the form that we have them because people began to worship together and they began to read out of our sacred literature at the worship that the church did. And they began to say that somehow we are animated by this word, and we understand now its centrality and its essential nature in our common life together. But Episcopalians, it's funny because we're the English church, have a Latin maxim, you know, lex credendi, lex orendi, the law of belief is the law of prayer, or the law of prayer is the law of belief. And that means we pray what we believe, and that's what early Christians did from the jump. God's light during the great 50 days of Easter is symbolically present in the Paschal candle, which is a symbol of, certainly to the Christians who co-opted this symbol in their liturgical life on Easter, it is a symbol of the pillar of fire that leads the people of Israel out through the wilderness, being the light that is going to turn them from their gaze at the place of remembered good times to the place where they will see a new self-definition and a deeper and fuller understanding of God's will and purpose for them as a people. So they will begin to see with a higher consciousness what it is they're supposed to do as they become part of God's plan for the cosmos. Christian people, as they have lived their history, as we have worshiped together, as we have read our sacred texts, as we have come to struggle with the realities on the ground, the pastoral experience of the church, also has come to realize that the light of God, the light of Christ, the divine light, is also external, leading us and showing us corporately. And it is an internal thing, shining on our emotional, spiritual, and mental states, giving us greater clarity and self-definition with regard to what we believe is God's will and purpose for us and how we might live. And so the illuminative processes of God are continuously at work in every soul, and it shows us that we are in fact made in God's image, and that we may be able to see the way to become what we already are. So the light, the divine light, is an essential part of the great 50 days of Easter. The divine life, in terms of the shape of the Easter liturgy, is given to us in the biblical witness. At the great vigil of Easter, which we celebrated last night, which is in fact ground zero for Christians, we read a number of readings from the Hebrew Bible, from the Old Testament. And in those readings we see embedded, certainly for the early Christians, an understanding that they are going to see in Jesus the unique focus of the divine presence, which have been promised to them in their sacred texts. And if they had looked at them with greater clarity, they would have begun to understand this. And more to the point, they knew all along that God was faithful and God unconditionally loved, accepted, and forgave them, and that that was the default position for how they were going to understand the teaching of Jesus, the meaning of his ministry, what they understand to mean by resurrection, transformation, new life. And so they came to call these sacred texts and reading these stories as the history of salvation, God's saving work. And just as with the light of Christ, they came to realize that the first way in which we hear these texts is corporately together as the assembly. Each of us read and hear these texts personally, and we react with them, and we begin to say, you know what? My personal history, my own history, has something to do with the history of salvation. That your history is important. My history is important. And it helps me understand more clearly and more fully God's purpose for me, and how I must live, and what I must do. I've been saying this a lot recently. Most of us think about being a good Christian, if we think about it at all, and think about it in heroic terms. We have to do some great and grand thing. Most of the time, you and I need to do some great and grand thing with regard to the commonplace activities of our own lives. In the classic spiritual life that I was taught in seminary, they're called the duties of state. Get up and brush your teeth. And so somehow in the course of that, we come to understand something about the history of salvation. God making whole the cosmos, the divine life. And the divine love is given to us in the last two parts of the shape of the Easter liturgy, which is baptism. And in a few minutes, we will renew our baptismal promises. And we will understand that the energy of baptism coursing through the church from the beginning is the empowerment, the presence of the Holy Spirit of God, God coming in an inward way to enlighten and strengthen us, to give us some understanding of who we are and what we're to do, and that sense of connection that we feel now one with another in sacramental terms, an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. And the second of the dominical sacraments, the Holy Eucharist, is the other way we see the outpouring of the divine love. By virtue of knowing that week to week we will be fed and sustained by this spiritual food and drink, We will be given the stamina and the ability to face the challenges and the opportunities that are in front of us, and we will find the ways and the means to do that. And I'm hoping that when you come to receive Holy Communion afterwards, you're going to feel better. Right? And when we feel better, we're more ready to meet the challenges and the opportunities that are in front of us. I told you this, when I was even more insufferable than I am now as a young priest, I never liked anybody telling me they felt better after they received Holy Communion. I just thought that was somehow too thin. I don't know what was the matter. Sometimes, I just don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it's good that you feel better. I feel better. And I think that's a good thing. The divine light, the divine life, and the divine love. So how is it manifested in the world? How would we do it? Are there any examples of how people might do it without falling into the caricature or stereotype of people who have been converted are now driving everybody nuts with their conversion and their religious vocabulary and their sense of zeal? A few years ago, I read this, so you're going to have to bear with me. I'm going to read it again. About 10 years ago, a guy named Neal Stephenson wrote a novel called Cryptonomicon. It's a big, thick book, and it takes you to all kinds of interesting places. But there is a section in Cryptonomicon where Neal Stephenson talks about something that I think is interesting. So here's a little background without getting into too much of the soap opera-ish aspects of the story. This is all about codes, code breaking, World War II, Japanese gold, guys running a company that does internet security, trying to find a site where this stuff can be safe in the Philippine Islands, getting hooked up with all kinds of interesting people. One of the main characters is a guy named Randy, who runs the company. He's from Seattle. And he left Seattle for a time on this jaunt, working with the company and everything. And before he left, he was involved with a woman named Charlene. And Charlene went off to Yale to get an advanced degree. And sort of the relationship went kind of like this. But you know, like people who lose difficult loved ones, they all of a sudden are elevated to sanctity afterwards. You know, the relationship goes awry, and all of a sudden, the fact that Randy isn't hooked up with Charlene for Charlene becomes the unforgivable sin. And she has the opportunity to dish Randy to all of her friends in Seattle. Meanwhile, Randy hooks up with Amy Shafto. And they come back to Seattle for a visit. And they go out to parties with some of their friends and so on. And Randy is the object of, shall we say, a number of frosty looks. So here's what Stevenson says about this. They're at this party. The friendliest and most sincere welcome he'd gotten, Randy, was from Scott, a chemistry professor, and Laura, a pediatrician, who, after knowing Randy and Charlene for many years, had one day divulged to Randy in strict confidence that unbeknownst to the academic community at large, they had been spiriting their three children off to church every Sunday morning and even had them all baptized. Randy had gone into their house once to help Scott wrestle a freshly reconditioned clawfoot bathtub up the stairs and had actually seen the word God written on actual pieces of paper stuck to the walls of their house, like on the refrigerator door and the walls of the children's bedrooms where juvenile art tends to be reposited. Little time-wasting projects that had been done during Sunday school. Pages torn from coloring books showing a somewhat more multicultural Jesus than the one Randy had grown up with. Talking to little biblical kids or assisting disoriented Holy Land livestock. The sight of this stuff around the house, commingled with normal, that is secular kid art junk from elementary school, Batman posters, etc., made Randy feel grossly embarrassed. It was like going to the house of some supposedly sophisticated people and finding a neon on black velvet Elvis painting hanging above their state-of-the-art Italian designer furniture. Definitely a social class thing. And it wasn't like Scott and Laura were deadly earnest types, and neither were they glassy-eyed and foaming at the mouth. They had, after all, managed to pass themselves off as members in good standing of a decent academic society for a number of years. They were a bit quieter than many others. They took up less space in the room, but then that was normal for people trying to raise three kids. And so they passed. Randy and Amy had spent a full hour talking to Scott and Laura last night. They were the only people who made any effort to make Amy feel welcome. Randy hadn't the faintest idea what these people thought of him and what he had done. But he could sense right away that, essentially, that was not the issue. Because even if they thought he had done something evil, they at least had a framework, a sort of procedure manual for dealing with transgressions. To translate it into Unix system administration terms, Randy's fundamental metaphor for just about everything, the postmodern politically correct atheists were like people who had suddenly found themselves in charge of a big and unfathomably complex computer system, that is, society, with no documentation or instructions of any kind, and so whose only way to keep the thing running was to invent and enforce certain rules with a kind of neo-puritanical rigor, because they were at a loss to deal with any deviations from what they saw as the norm. Whereas people who were wired into a church were like Unix system administrators who, while they might not understand everything, at least had some documentation, some FAQs, some how-tos, and README files, providing some guidance on what to do when things got out of whack. They were, in other words, capable of adaptability. So you know what? Living the Christian life may have something to do with the light of God working on your internal, emotional, spiritual, and mental states to allow you to have the kind of adaptability that you need in order to function at the healthiest and best level. If you begin to see that you are finding it easier to suffer fools gladly, that you're a little kinder, a little peacefuler, a little less judgmental, a little less anxious in front of people who are a pain in the neck, you may be making some spiritual progress. And you know, one day somebody who may see you operate will come up to you and they'll say, "How do I get what you have? I notice the way you are, the way you do some things, and I admire those things, and I would like to be able to do them myself. So I would like to know how you do that." And my friends, you will have an evangelical moment, the opportunity to command your greatest place of safety and assurance. Amy and Scott were able to do that by the way in which they interacted with Amy and Laura, and Amy and Randy. They took them seriously, you know. It isn't a cliche to say that in some of the most godless governments in this world in the last 100 or 150 years, some of the most neo-puritanical and atrocious behavior has been made manifest. It makes Christian bad behavior look like amateur night. Now, Episcopalians understand what I read to you as saying, you know how we begin to come to this? From the tradition point of view, or as part of it, is to say the Bible is important to us, the tradition with a capital T is important to us, and our human reason and experience is important to us. And as we begin to use those things and bring them to bear on the deep things of human existence, we begin to get some elevation of our consciousness, some ability to move forward, some way to clean up whatever is unhealthy in our relational life, so that we can be the transparencies and reflections of God's grace and love that we're called to be. All human beings yearn for this, and all human beings experience it in big and small ways. We just want to be able to learn how to do that with a little bit more intention. Charles Taylor, who is a philosopher, wrote a wonderful book about 2 or 3 years ago called A Secular Age. It's not, you know, something you'd sort of sit and read when you're having a Pepsi. It requires a little work, but it's a wonderful book. And he says at one point, we all see in our lives and or the space wherein we live our lives as having a certain moral spiritual shape. Somewhere in some activity or condition lies a fullness, a richness. That is, in that place, activity or condition, life is fuller, deeper, more worthwhile, more admirable, more what it should be. This is perhaps a place of power. We often experience this as deeply moving, as inspiring. Perhaps this sense of fullness is something we just catch glimpses of from afar off. We have the powerful intuition of what fullness would be were we to be in that condition, for example, of peace or wholeness, or able to act on that level of integrity or generosity or abandonment of self. But sometimes there will be moments of experienced fullness, of joy and fulfillment, where we feel ourselves there. That's what the church has called, since the jump, salvation, wholeness, fullness, the ability to understand something about what it feels like to be complete. So as you begin the 50 great days of Easter, think about God's light, God's life, and God's love. You participate in this. God's light, God's life, and God's love is inside you. Father Thomas Keating says it's your true self. We are not God, but our true self is God. Give thanks for the divine light, the divine life, and the divine love. And give thanks for the risen Christ on this Easter. Amen.